On today's show, we talk with Around the World pilot, president of Fly with Amelia Foundation, and keynote speaker Amelia Rose Earhart. You're listening to the Eagles Talent Podcast. This podcast is brought to you by Eagles Talent Speakers Bureau, for speakers who inspire, educate, and entertain. You can find us online at eaglestalent.com. Remember, you can listen to our podcast on our site, eaglestalent.com, or subscribe to it on iTunes by simply typing Eagles Talent in the search. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Eagles Talent Podcast. I am your host, Ari Frangias, and I am here with Amelia Earhart. Welcome to the revival of the Eagles Talent Podcast.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Thanks for joining us. So in 2014, you completed Amelia Earhart's 1937 flight plan and became one of the youngest women to ever fly around the world, which is a huge accomplishment.
Thank you.
In a recent interview, you mentioned, "My parents named me after a woman who knew the risk and proceeded anyway, daring to show the world that adventure is worthwhile in itself." When and how did you realize who you were named after?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I realized who I was named after from a very, very young age. So second and third grade, I can remember my teachers spending, you know, a week or 2 weeks just on Amelia Earhart. Now, it always gets singled out. Mm-hmm. My parents would collect books about Amelia. They would get sent books about Amelia from other family members, newspaper clippings. So very early on, I realized that this name was different from everyone else's, mm-hmm. with the exception of one person. And that, of course, was the original Amelia Earhart. But it was later in life, my high school years, when I really started to understand just how potential filled this name was. In terms of flying, in terms of representing myself and the type of woman that I wanted to become. But I definitely knew it from a very, very young age.
Right. What was that like being in school when, I know that you mentioned like second or third grade teachers would be mentioning Amelia Earhart. Did you ever get looks from the other kids? Like,
oh, yeah.
Wait a minute.
Lots of looks. I got teased a lot.
Oh, really?
You know, you think about every kid gets teased about their name. Mm-hmm. For some reason, right? Kids are kind of mean in that sense, and they'll make up anything to tease each other. But with the name Amelia Earhart, I think that the teasing went on because of the mystery surrounding Amelia, right? Mm-hmm. When a bunch of elementary school kids learned that this woman flew a long time ago, she disappeared, no one knows what happened to her, but then they've got this girl in their class named Amelia Earhart, it's sort of like, ooh, you know, you're a tomboy, you like to fly airplanes, or you could fly airplanes. That's not what the rest of us like to do, because mm-hmm. little girls were wearing pink frilly dresses and the little boys were the ones who were supposed to like airplanes. And so I think because Amelia was so adventurous and so different as a woman, I got teased because of that. And I didn't really know how to handle it. So for a long time, I really hid from the name. And I went by Amy. Yeah, I went by Amy for short because it just made conversations easier.
Mm-hmm. Do people still call you Amy?
You know, occasionally my dad will slip and he'll call me Amy. It was a nickname at home, but mm-hmm. at school I definitely took it a lot more seriously. But I would say 99% of people in my world call me Amelia. If I do hear Amy, I perk up and it sort of takes me back to those
elementary
and junior high school years. Yeah.
Great. Did you ever feel pressure to become a pilot?
Yeah, every single day. And
really?
Every single day to this day in my life, I feel the pressure to fly. And that's actually, it's sort of a new feeling that I'm grappling with in terms of where do I go after the flight around the world, right? Mm-hmm. As I completed my flight in 2014, and I still fly to this day, and I've got my commercial license, I've got, you know, additional ratings I want to work on with my multi-engine ratings and things like that. Mm-hmm. But the pressure to fly and the pressure to stay simply within aviation, just aviation, is really, really strong. And it's something that I talk to my audiences about quite a bit, that feeling of being typecast, right? Just because you're good at one thing doesn't mean that you can't be good at a number of others. And so I've got all sorts of things I want to explore, but sometimes I hesitate. Can Amelia Earhart host a cooking show someday? Can Amelia Earhart design a clothing line? Can Amelia Earhart become a yoga instructor? Because I think, oh, will that not make sense for people? Do they only want to see me in an airplane?
Well, I will 100% tune into the Amelia Earhart cooking show.
Yes.
So you let me know what channel that's airing on. How old were you the first time that you piloted a plane?
My very first flight lesson, I was 21 years old. And the reason I waited so long was because mom and dad and the rest of the family didn't have the funds to put me through flight school. You know, it's a very expensive process. Right. So I saved up for that first lesson, and it happened in Boulder, Colorado. And from that very first lesson, which was not an ideal setting, you know, it was kind of an old plane. It wasn't beautiful. It wasn't glamorous. Mm-hmm. The instructor was just kind of this grumpy old man. And all of that disappeared as soon as we took off. And so I felt like I could see the potential in that. I didn't know what direction it would go. And I certainly didn't know that I would fly around the world someday in that moment. But that's when I knew I was hooked.
Did you feel like this is where I'm supposed to be? Like, aside from the, you know, the way the plane looked, the grumpy instructor, did you feel like you sat down and you were like, wow, this is comfortable?
Oh, yeah. I felt at total ease in the airplane, which isn't the case for everyone, right? Mm-hmm. Flying small airplanes, it can be nerve-wracking and it can feel dangerous. But for me, I felt that distance between where I was flying in the air and the ground. And that really put things into perspective for me. You know, Amelia's got this beautiful quote. The original Amelia Earhart said, "You've never seen a tree until you've seen its shadow from the sky." And to me, it gives me chills. And I say that out loud because it's true. The perspective that flying gives you allows you to step back and say, you know what? The little things don't matter as much, mm-hmm. but the big things like family and love and connection, those things really matter. And that's what I really think about a lot when I'm up there in the cockpit.
That's amazing. That's such a beautiful way to look at it. That's amazing. That's a wonderful quote. Mm-hmm. Back in 2014, as we said, you successfully completed your flight around the world. How physically demanding was that?
It was really tough. Leading up to the flight, you know, I was managing 21 different sponsor partnerships.
Wow.
We were configuring the airplane along with Pilatus, our aircraft manufacturer, to get the fuel tank ready. We had to design an interior tank to carry extra fuel on board the plane. I was driving from essentially South Denver all the way to the north side of town, which could be an hour and a half to 2 hours. I was making that trip a couple times a day while still working my full-time job at the NBC affiliate here in town, working in television. That was just leading up to the trip. All the interviews, flying out to New York to do the Today Show interviews, you know, phone calls in the middle of the night with people from different countries who wanted to interview me about the upcoming trip. That was all one side. Mm-hmm. It was actually easier once I got in the plane and shut that door, because then I knew it was all about flying. Right. It wasn't about logistics and planning and packing. It was more about enjoying the view, getting safely from one destination to the next, and enjoying the view along with my co-pilot, Shane Jordan. And the two of us, we sat back and we thought, gosh, now the fun part begins.
Right. I would imagine that, like you said, when you finally got into the plane, I would imagine that it was just you and your goal.
Right.
And it was, everything else was just, it was part of it. It was necessary, but now it's time to focus.
There's this really neat image that every pilot sees when they're taking off on a runway. And when you taxi up to the runway, you always line up the nose of the aircraft with the center line. Mm-hmm. And seeing no buildings in the distance because you're so low on the ground, you're staring down that long path. And I thought, my goodness, this is the runway that's going to send me all the way around the world. And what a beautiful metaphor, right? Right. Wherever we are in our lives, that's where we can start. That's where our takeoff point is. And there may be bumps along the way, as we always talk about, but when it comes right down to it, that's the runway that you take off from, is exactly where you are at that particular moment. And when I'm thinking about big goals I want to work on, I'm like, I'm already parked on my runway, right? All I need to do is push that throttle forward.
I love that. That's great. So I know you touched on it a little, but how did you prepare for this? I mean, this huge expedition you're about to go on.
So the trip planning itself, I would say idea-wise, probably took about 10 years to really get up the courage to get close enough to saying, I'm going to quit my job and fly around the world, right? The actual logistic side of things, getting the sponsors together to help me afford to be able to do this, right? Because you can't do it on your own. You've got to build a team of total experts who can help you navigate and help you plan the course and calculate fuel and think about the weather component to the trip, what I would eat along the flight, which hotels I would stay in safely, how would I get through customs? I had to get two passports before the trip because when you're applying for visas in 14 different countries, you've got one passport that you've got to keep with you to travel around the world and go. I had to go to Switzerland to pick up the plane while my second passport was being sent to get, permission to fly into Tanzania.
That's a lot.
Logistics, and I have a hard time handing off, tasks to anyone else, and so I'm like, I'm going to do this all. I've got to keep it organized, and I did it all through my Gmail, believe it or not.
Really? Wow.
And of course, the team of people that helped are just incredible, but that was on the aircraft side, logistics, navigation, routing, security and safety. And I can't give them enough credit for what they did for my trip. But boy, the mental strain on everyone leading up to it was just intense for 2 years. And then I would say the last 6 months of that 2 year period, if you look at my calendar, and I still have the backlogs of all those calendar dates, everything just hour by hour, and sometimes broken into 15-minute increments, these interviews and stories leading up to it. So it was intense.
That is intense. How long did it take you to make that decision? I'm going to follow Amelia Earhart's original plan. Was that always the plan when you first went into piloting?
No, definitely not. I mean, I've always had it in the back of my mind since I was a child because people always said to me, someday you should fly around the world. And when you tell a kid something like that, it tends to stick. And it put a lot of pressure on me that what if I don't want to fly around the world? What if I don't enjoy small aircraft? What if I don't want to do this type of trip? Well, somehow I pushed all of those ideas away and I said, I have to do this. My life will not be complete until I do it, which in hindsight, I would have been fine without the journey around the world, of course. But now that I look back, I'm so glad that I forced myself to just make the decision to say, yes, we're going to do it, come hell or high water. Whatever happens leading up to it, we've got to make this attempt. And I'm so proud and grateful and happy that it all came together so safely.
And that's such a big commitment to make, to say I'm gonna successfully complete this. And the fact that you followed through and actually did it, I mean, is amazing.
Thank you. Thank you. When I look back and I'm, what is it? It's Wednesday today. I've just worked a full shift at the morning show here in Denver on the NBC affiliate where I work. I'm exhausted. I get up at 2:45 in the morning and I look back at myself leading up to the flight around the world and I think, how on earth did I do all of that? But it's because I was passionate about it, right? The things that we want to do come easier than the things that we want to put off till later. And that was a big sign for me. It was fun and joyful to plan that trip. And sure, there were plenty of stressful moments and lots of turbulence.
How did that work? Did you take a hiatus? Did you do both at the same time? Because that's a lot to take on.
So leading up to the trip, I realized, looking at the schedule, I was booking all of these post flight around the world. So after I'd safely completed the flight, we need you to fly to New York. We need you to fly to Zurich. We need to bring you to Tokyo. There's interviews. There's people who want to bring you in as a speaker, And I was looking at all of these requests and I thought, I can't have a full-time job and fulfill all of these requirements. And so I was able to say to my television station, look, when the time is right, I'll come back, but I need to take a break. And it was a 2 year stretch that I stayed away from, those early wake-up calls, but I traveled the world and I got to speak to so many people and have so many incredible adventures post-flight.
Well, that actually leads into my next question. I know that you spent between 8 to 9 hours a day flying when you were on your trip. What were your rest stops like? Did you explore any local cities, talk to any of the natives? What was that like?
Oh, absolutely. And the way that the schedule worked out, I would fly 8 to 9 hours a day, land, go through customs, which typically took at least an hour, in some places up to 4 hours,
Wow.
to go through the plane, make sure I wasn't smuggling anything strange, make sure I had all the appropriate permits. So that took a long time. At that point, as you can imagine, if you're driving a car for 8 hours a day, that wears you out, right?
Right.
Times that by about 50 flying an airplane. And people will say, oh, you had autopilot. Sure, I had autopilot and I used it most of the time in cruise control or cruising altitude because the plane will fly so much safer than any human can. There were several stretches that I hand flew, and of course, all takeoffs and landings and changes like that were done hand flying. But when it came right down to it, it was so exhausting thinking about the fact that you're over an ocean, you
Right.
only have one engine, and if that engine fails, you'll have to ditch the airplane into the water, which I had gone through open water survival training, and I had gone through, oh gosh, countless tasks to learn how to manage that risk.
Right.
But the exhaustion that kicked in when I landed forced us to basically meet everyone at the airport, get some food in us, and immediately fall asleep in most locations. Because the following morning, I was up well before dawn. I had the goal of seeing the sunrise around the whole globe. And that meant taking off, at 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning in most spots. And on top of that, we were flying eastbound, so we were losing hours as we went. There were two rest days. The first was south of India in the Maldives. We did get to spend 24 hours there and rest, which was a very beautiful place to take a rest,
Of course.
tropical waters and just gorgeous scenery. And then the other spot was in Darwin, Australia. And the reason
Wow.
there was because our Pratt & Whitney partners looked over the engine and they went in and they said, okay, is the engine safe for Amelia and Shane to cross over the South Pacific? And so they were able to do that engine check with us and give us the go ahead to continue.
Did you explore at all in India and Australia or just rest? Which is understandable if, because you need a nap after all
Oh, no,
that.
I slept really well that first night. But yeah, when we were in the Maldives, I went snorkeling, I went swimming, I wanted to take pictures everywhere I went.
That's
I had a
amazing.
blast, ate some really good food. And then in Darwin, I got a chance to explore the city. We saw some live music one night, had a great dinner, just kind of caught up on logistics. I ended up doing an interview with the Australian TV show down south, and it was a part of, they call it their Today Show in Australia. And so it was funny because I got, I put makeup on and I thought, oh, I'm just feels like I'm going to work.
Yeah, it just felt natural. So, I know as you just said, you did some snorkeling. Would you consider yourself an adventure seeker?
Well, I don't think snorkeling is that
Well,
adventurous,
it's
but
not that adventurous, but you did fly around the world and then still made time to do some exploring and all that.
oh, yeah.
I personally would go and just sleep all day.
Oh,
So,
not if you're in the Maldives, trust me. You would get out and explore.
right.
It's those beautiful and unique and curious parts of the world that make me get out of bed in the morning.
Right.
If there's a chance to travel, I will sneak it in any way I possibly can. For instance, I got an opportunity to go to Switzerland recently, and I literally flew there after my morning shift, flew to Switzerland, did a speaking engagement. I was on the ground for about 6 hours, got right back in a plane and flew right back home and went back to work, I think 2 days later.
Wow.
So the chance that the people that you meet when you put yourself out there on a limb and you say, you know what, this isn't what most people would do, but this is what I want to do. And those parts, oh gosh, they just make me feel alive. It makes
Yeah.
me want to hop in an airplane right now and go fly somewhere beautiful.
It makes all the hard work worth it,
It
right?
does. Yeah, it makes the sacrifice that you take, leading up to a big adventure. Maybe you aren't as able to go out and be social with your friends as much, or go out to dinner as often as you'd like, saving every penny to make the trip work. And those sacrifices now pay off when I look at these beautiful memories that I have, and they also give me the courage to go anywhere in the world. And I'm not scared to travel by myself. I'm not scared to go walk up to somebody and say hello, even if we don't speak the same language, because you can always see that language in someone's eyes.
Right.
And that's the common thread.
It's the universal language.
Yes, exactly.
So when you followed Amelia Earhart's 1937 flight pattern, did you have to adjust your route at all? Maybe for no-fly zones or anything like that?
I did. Not too drastically, but Amelia's trip, she did much shorter hops along the way so that she could, it was a much older aircraft, obviously, a lot less technology. She used steam gauges and celestial navigation. I had GPS and synthetic vision and a beautiful modern aircraft. So I was able to fly longer hops. But essentially, Oakland through Denver into Miami was the same, Trinidad into Natal, Brazil was the same. Dakar, Senegal, and that's where it sort of broke off. Amelia's original journey went north through the Middle East. I needed to go further south, so I went through São Tomé and Tanzania, Seychelles Islands, the Maldives, and then I sort of linked back up with Amelia's trip near Singapore, and then down through Darwin, Australia, into Papua New Guinea, and continuing into the South Pacific was the same route. The last journey that Amelia was able to take before she disappeared was her departure from Papua New Guinea, heading into Kiribati or Tarawa, tiny little island atolls in the middle of the South Pacific. She never made it to Howland, and there's all sorts of theories, as we know, about what happened to Amelia. But one of the most special moments in along the journey was when I got to circle over Howland Island, this tiny little speck of sand, out there in the South Pacific Ocean. I got to circle over, see where Amelia and her navigator Fred Noonan wanted to land, and that was a beautiful moment for me.
I can't even imagine. That must be such a moment of like, wow, this is what I was meant to do, right?
It really was. And, just as there is with any adventure or any journey that people embark on, there are people who criticize what you do and try to make you feel guilty for what you're doing, or like you don't deserve to be on a trip like that, or because you're not related to Amelia, you shouldn't be on this trip. And at that moment, I was able to let go of all that anger and all that fear around judgment. And I thought, you know what? Those people who are criticizing me are sitting back home on their couches, on their phones, being angry. And I'm flying over Howland Island at 27,000 feet in this beautiful, safe aircraft. And I'm reenacting Amelia Earhart's 1937 flight. And when I picture that stark difference, that's where it all came together. And I thought, I'm in the right place. And that's where we handed out our scholarships for the Fly with Amelia Foundation and let girls all over the US, 10 girls, know that they had the money to now learn how to fly and get their private pilot's licenses.
That's amazing.
I don't think that my flight was anywhere close to being as dangerous or challenging as the original Amelia flight. It was more of a symbolic do it for Amelia kind of trip. But I think that there was enough of a challenge to it to where I feel like she and I really do have the same spirit.
I know you said it wasn't as dangerous as the original Amelia's flight, but were there any moments where you felt like your life was in danger?
Oh, yes,
Really?
there were several storms along the way where when you're flying over the middle of a massive ocean, we're talking the Indian Ocean, the Pacific Ocean, the Atlantic Ocean, not a large lake body of water. We're talking oceans with nowhere to land, one single engine. When you run into a storm and that plane is getting rocked around and the cargo in the back is getting shifted and bounced around and you've got to hold onto those controls so tight and deviate around those storms, yes, you start to question, was this the right decision? Should we have taken another route? Should we have stayed back and waited?
Really?
Now, on the ground, that was in the sky, and of course everything turned out fine, but in on the ground, dealing with different personalities outside of the US, not everyone understood why I was on this journey. And especially when I entered into Papua New Guinea. And that was the last place that Amelia was ever seen before she disappeared. But when I landed at the airport, I was told, "You are at the wrong airport," in very broken English, a very intimidating situation, military style. Men were all dressed in different kind of military style outfits and uniforms, but they didn't look like they were all part of the same group. They came up to me and they all had guns. This is, why are you here? Who are you? You're at the wrong airport. Well, I had my paperwork that said this is the right location. This is exactly where I'm supposed to be. And it took probably about 4 hours to get through that situation. I had to wait inside the airplane. It was sweltering hot. I hadn't used the restroom since I departed at 6 o'clock in the morning. By the time I finally got inside the airport and had a chance to use an absolutely filthy, broken down restroom. I mean, it was probably 14 hours later. I mean, it was so intense. Finally, I was able to pay some additional cash to get someone to come to the airport and deal with my customs paperwork. And in the end, it turns out that I sure was at the right airport, but I kind of got the
Wow.
feeling that I wasn't exactly welcome there. Where they ended up writing in the newspaper about the event and saying, Amelia came through, and they didn't have very nice things to say about me.
Really? Do you
Yeah.
think that any of it had to do with the fact that you were a female pilot?
I think so. There were plenty of situations where I got off the airplane. I had my paperwork all organized in my folder. I was ready to go. Passports, everything. Here you go. This is why we're here. And people refused to take me seriously. They said, "Where's your pilot? Where's your pilot? Where's your pilot?" I said, "I'm the pilot." No. Where's your pilot?" They thought I was either a flight attendant or a passenger. And especially in Papua New Guinea, it took me standing next to Shane, my co-pilot, who's a male, obviously, saying, "No, she's the pilot. Look at her name right here." And that I think it had a lot to do with it.
Well, I remember reading, I think it was when you first landed, back in 2014 after the flight around the world. I remember reading that a pilot came up to you. I think you were taking pictures, next to the plane, and a pilot came up and said, "Do you want a pilot to be in the picture with you?" I mean, so absurd and ridiculous.
Oh
But
yeah. But
how much of that has experienced?
I share that story in my keynote address because it blows people's minds that this still happens. But
Right.
today, if let's say that after this interview, I want to go for a flight, I could throw on a pair of jeans and a t-shirt and go to the airport, be carrying my flight bag out to an airplane, and people will still stop me and say, "Are you looking for someone? Do you need help? Are you looking for your husband?"
Oh my gosh.
I'm going, "Well, I'm going to go fly that airplane right over there. So I need some fuel. Thank you."
Well, according to the Airline Pilots Association, women only make up 5% of its 53,000 members. As a female pilot and a member of that 5%, what challenges have you faced aside from people's ignorance? Because, I mean, it is ignorance.
The challenge that I face is when I say I fly airplanes, people go, "Oh my goodness, that's so special, and oh, that's so cute, and oh my gosh, you poor thing, do you get tired up there? Can you fly the airplane by yourself?" And nobody says that to a man. If
Right.
a man says, "I fly airplanes," they go, "Oh, which airline do you fly for?"
That's just so ridiculous and so unfortunate.
Yeah, and it's the real reason behind my foundation. That's why I want to give girls the funds to fly so that they can increase that number,
Right.
because 5% is unacceptable.
Let's get that 5% to 50 and up.
I know.
Absolutely.
Well, we've got a huge pilot shortage coming up, which means they are going to require so many different types of people to become pilots because, it's if we suddenly don't have pilots to fly us from destination to destination and fares increase
Right.
on commercial airline flights, that's when people are really going to go, "Oh, there is a pilot shortage."
Right. And hopefully we can fill that shortage.
I hope so, because flying an airplane is one of the most empowering, joyful things that you can do. And there's no view like taking off during sunrise or flying in what I like to call skies filled with impossible colors, colors that you don't know exist on the ground. When you're above the clouds and you're flying in a clear sky with the moon out, I mean, these colors are just so beautiful, and they illuminate the tops of the wings. And it's something that I have a hard time finding the words to describe, but
It's
it is,
breathtaking.
it's breathtaking. It makes me want to go up again and again.
Wow, that's beautiful.
Thank you.
How did it feel to make history when you landed? So, aside from that pilot and his ridiculous statements, when you landed, I mean, that must have been the most phenomenal feeling in the world.
It was pretty incredible. I had that feeling of, let's land and let's say hi to everyone, but let's keep going.
Right.
I didn't want it to be over. It was 28,000 miles over the course of 18 days. I flew through 14 countries, and all of a sudden I was back in America. And Yes, I wanted to see my family. I wanted to see my friends and do all the interviews, but it was a feeling of adventure doesn't stop here. Just because the flight is over doesn't mean I have to stop living my life like the adventurous Amelia Mary Earhart back in the 1930s. And so that's how I try to go about everything I do. If I'm in, I'm all in. If I'm out, I'm all out. You know, that middle ground, wishy-washy, is kind of tough. So it's made since the flight around the world, it's made me better at committing to the things that I love and turning down the things that I don't.
And that's a great mindset to have. I mean, doesn't get better than that.
It's tough because we all commit to things we don't necessarily really want to do, and we do them because, oh, we feel like we have to. And it's not like I'm rejecting people all over the place. I'm saying, you know what? Let's go all in. Let's figure out why we love these things.
So before your flight, I saw in an interview that you mentioned you wanted to become a public speaker once you were done. What prompted you to take that next step?
Well, I always worked in some form of public speaking. So in high school, I was a part of the speech and debate team. In my very first job out of college, which was at a radio station here in Denver, I enjoyed the thrill and the nerves that came along with it. I took a job in a helicopter working at the radio station, and so I was able to speak from the chopper. That was great. And then I got into TV and did the same thing. And when I thought about this flight around the world, I got calls from all over the globe, and I still do, people saying, "Will you come and share your story with us?" And for me, speaking is has never been a nerve-wracking situation. It feels similar to crawling into the cockpit, you know,
It feels
sort of
comfortable.
strap on that seatbelt and off you go. And so when I walk out on stage, I feel like I'm pushing the throttle forward and I am taking off and I'm taking everyone along with me on that journey. And when I finish my talk, the best feeling I have is when you see everybody in the room wiping the tears from their eyes because I tend to end on a very emotional note. But people come up to me and they say, "I want to give you a hug. You know, I want to get out and do this thing that I've been putting off for years." And that, as a speaker, is the best feeling you could ask for.
So, as you know, in aviation, there's a pre-flight checklist, which is a list of tasks that should be performed by pilots prior to takeoff. So, what I want to know is, before you speak to an organization, do you have a speaker checklist? What's on it, if you do?
Well, you guys help me out so much with a lot of that
Oh, I
checklist.
love to hear that.
But when it comes down to how I prepare for a talk, I love to research the group that I'm speaking to, obviously know what the theme of their event is. I usually have three or four phone calls with their team, and not just the leader who's putting the event together. I like to get on Twitter and dive in and see what kind of conversations they're having socially. Read any blogs that they may have put out, because if I walk on stage and I'm speaking a similar language and using terms that we can both agree on that are meaningful, for instance, I've got an event coming up with a company that works in the workers' comp field. And I don't know anything about workers' compensation, but now that I've had three or four conversations with this group, I understand that we don't refer to the person who's hurt. We don't refer to them as a client or a customer. We refer to them as the injured worker because that's what they are. They've been hurt at work. They are the injured worker. And what these professionals who are putting on this event tell me is, if you refer to the person as the injured worker, they're immediately going to trust you. So I think that that type of research is very, very important. The morning of, or the afternoon before, whatever the schedule may be, before I head down and really start meeting everyone and getting ready to go on stage, I always have my passport with me. And I have a very special memento from my flight, which is a patch that was given to me as a gift. And that goes in my bag, and it is close to me at all times when I'm speaking. And so that has gone around the world, and it's also gone with me now towards all my speaking engagements since.
That must make you feel like no matter where you are in the world, you're close to home.
Right. It keeps me grounded. And it reminds me why I'm so lucky to be the person standing on stage sharing my story. The fact that people want to hear that story still blows my mind, and it makes me so proud.
And I think what makes your keynote, sorry, so captivating and relatable is that you do that research and you establish a connection, because I think that's probably the most important thing when it comes to speaking, is being able to connect with the audience. And I think you do that so well.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. It's, you know, I've been in the audience too. And that's what I think speakers really need to remember, is picture yourself in the audience. Mm-hmm. And if you see a speaker walk on stage who, if everyone in the audience is dressed in, you know, business attire, and they're treating it like a formal event, and you show up very casual and sloppy, you know, they're going to go, wait a minute, does this person not take us seriously? Mm-hmm. And so I really try to match not only my understanding of the event, but the look and feel. And I make it very clear beforehand, what type of experience do you have? How do you want to feel when I'm done on stage? And I really try to match that. And if it has anything to do with any positive emotion, you can bet I'll be right there.
Well, it comes through for sure. Just from watching your keynotes, you can just feel it.
Thank you.
So speaking of your keynotes, Learning to Love the Turbulence, one of your speaking programs, where you explain the importance of embracing difficulty and change once your goal is airborne. What kind of audiences do you think can benefit from this philosophy?
Well, it's a pretty universal metaphor, but I also don't want to be that speaker that says my keynote's perfect for everyone. Mm-hmm. My favorite types of audiences would have to be people who, whether it's companies or college students or women's groups, but groups that are going through a time of change or challenge. So industries that are experiencing maybe a reduction in profit or a lack of leads when it comes to sales. If it's a university, maybe they're going through implementing a new, you know, women's studies program. So wherever change is taking place, I think my talk fits particularly well. And the reason is, just like any story that any speaker is going to share with you that has a beginning, a middle, and the end, I like to say that my speech has a takeoff, a cruise, and a landing. And I take you through those steps. And in the end, the talk feels very complete. And the takeaways that the audience has at the end shows you how to plan for a takeoff, right? How to deal with the bumps along that cruise, the turbulence that comes along the way when you're up 27,000 feet in the air, but the importance of landing safely, because a lot of speakers will get you right up there to the top. And then mm-hmm. they're like, thank you. Enjoy, right? You're at the
right.
top. So I talk about coming back down from these big events that you may go through and what it feels like to succeed at a complete goal. What do you do next? So, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's such a good point that you bring up, because I do think that landing is so important and so vital to a really successful keynote. So over the years, there have been many different theories, as you mentioned before, regarding Amelia's disappearance. Most recently, the History Channel released a lost photo. Has there ever been a theory that stuck out to you, or you personally choose to believe, or anything like that?
Well, I'll tell you what, this most recent theory with the History Channel, mm-hmm. that got me closer than I have ever been before.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I was convinced. But then the book basically proving that the photo was actually from 1935 as opposed to 1937, which would dispel the whole theory, broke it down.
Right.
Now,
right.
That was intriguing. And some of the researchers who worked on that documentary got in touch with me right before and said, hey, we really want you to watch. We'd love to hear your thoughts afterwards. And so that was engaging. But my theory, still to this day, the best one that I can associate with, is that Amelia and Fred ran out of fuel looking for Howland Island or another safe place to land and eventually crashed in the ocean. And even with that, I don't give it a lot of thought. And the reason is, there are researchers out there, there are experts, there are people who do this for a living, searching for lost aircraft. I want to let them focus on her disappearance. I want to focus on what Amelia stood for when she was alive.
Right.
And what people forget about Amelia Earhart is that she was 39 years old when she disappeared. We focus on the last 20 minutes of her life. She led 39 beautiful years as a fashion designer, as a social worker, as a sister, as a wife. You know, she designed her own line of luggage. She, of course, all of her aviation feats. So when it comes down to it, I want to focus on all of that, not just that last 20 minutes.
That's such an excellent point.
Imagine your own life. Say that you do all this hard work and you go to school and you create a career and a family and you do all these things that you love, and your legacy is how you die. that's disappointing. It takes away from the importance of the day in and the day out, the planning and the importance that we place on things that really matter to us. And so that's how I'm trying to live my life. And hopefully, you know, hopefully in the end, it's not all about those last few minutes. It's about the process.
That's a great, an amazing way to look at it.
When you think about if a male were to disappear in the same situation, they might think, well, maybe the aircraft failed. Mm-hmm. But with a woman disappearing, we hear she got lost.
That's a good point. That's an excellent point. I mean, I hope it's something that a mindset that just changes.
I hope so. We've got a long way to go, though. I mean, still to this day, there are people who say to me, oh, well, you had a co-pilot. He must have done all the flying. You slept in the back. You showed up, met everybody and left. But I like to say to those people, you know, who was going to go in the back and switch the fuel tank over? Who was going to fly the plane when we had to switch to our auxiliary tank that gave us 2,500 nautical mileage or nautical miles of distance to be able to fly so that we could cross oceans? You know, people don't think about the complications there. People will say, oh, that must have been nice. You know, you got to go on a pleasure cruise around the world. And I like to ask them back, when was your last flight around the world? Because again, it's usually the folks that aren't working on big things that want to criticize the most.
Right. And I hope that we reach a point where we don't even have to say, oh, Amelia, a female pilot, you're a pilot.
That is an excellent point. It's an excellent point. The plane doesn't know if it's being controlled by a man or a woman.
Right.
It just knows whether it's landed safely and smoothly and if anything's damaged. And that is a good feeling to come back to. You know, there is a part of me that likes the surprise when I'm in a crowd and you meet a new person and they say, oh, what do you do? I say, oh, I'm a pilot. And they go, what? You know, wait a minute. What does that mean? And I wish that it wasn't such a talking point. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I know that it does make me stand out in a crowd. And we should all hope to find something about ourselves that makes us stand out and be different than everyone else.
Right. I think it's 100% just so important to celebrate our differences, but also realize that we should focus on our accomplishments too and let them speak for themselves.
Yes. And letting them speak for themselves is the best part, because at the end of the day, once you've done what you set out to do, you can sit back and say, I put my all into it. And that's what feels good. And that's what helps me sleep well at night.
So lastly, August is What Will Your Legacy Be month. And it's a month for people to reflect on their actions and vow to make positive changes that will affect generations to come. So your Fly With Amelia Foundation honors that theme by giving young women the opportunity to obtain their private pilot's license. Aside from completing your historic flight and starting this phenomenal foundation, what do you want your legacy to be?
Gosh, if it's outside of flying and it's outside of the foundation, I just want it to be kindness. I want every person that I meet to feel listened to. I want them to feel welcome and appreciated for who they are and not what they are supposed to be or should be eventually, but just who they are in that very moment. Mm-hmm. And I know that I am constantly a work in progress, right? Just like everyone else. And so that is, for some people, maybe a boring answer that I want my legacy to be kindness. But
not
when it
all
comes to it, that's what people remember, is how you made them feel. And that's why I want to hear everybody's story. And when I go and I walk into an event and I've got a speaking engagement, and there's 500 people in the room, you know, I do my best to move around and walk through those crowds and say, you know, you're going to hear my story once I'm up on stage. Let's not spend our time talking about flying. I want to hear about you. Tell me what struggles you're going through. What's it like to work in your company or go to this school or participate in this event? And I feel so much more comfortable on stage when I look out and I see that friendly smile of somebody that I've had a great conversation with. And so I would say it's kindness.
I think kindness is probably the most perfect answer that you could have given. And it radiates off of you. You're amazing. That's all I can say. You're amazing.
Thank you.
So, Amelia, thank you so much for chatting with me.
Thank you.
And being part of our first podcast since we revived the Eagles Talent podcast series. Again, everyone who's listening, be sure to follow Amelia on all social media. Amelia_Earhart on Twitter, right?
And it's easy to find. Just search for the Amelia Earhart that's not a black and white photo.
Right. Good point. And Amelia Rose Earhart on Facebook and Instagram, right?
Yes.
And for more information, of course, be sure to visit Amelia Rose Earhart's speaker page on eaglestalent.com.